From New Mexico to Ohio, Oregon to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve has implemented the first interest rate cut in 4 years. Does that signal a change in focus? Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with the answer. Congress has once again kicked the can down the road, failing to pass the federal budget on time and postponing hard choices until December. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are opposed to the proposed merger of U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to explain why both are wrong. And Kamala Harris did a softball interview with Oprah Winfrey and still couldn't coherently answer questions. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Federal Reserve has cut its target interest rate for the first time since 2020, and that could signal employment is replacing inflation as its top concern. Ryan Young is senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's here to discuss the impact. Ryan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ryan, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors did a 50 basis point, 0.5% cut in interest rates here recently. That's a pretty big change from recent policy, actually, in the scope of things, a relatively large cut. Your thoughts on what prompted such a large cut?
There was some debate over whether they do a small cut, 25 basis points, or a big cut, 50. They went big, and I think the reason is that the Fed is changing its mission. The Fed actually has two missions that it has to follow. One of them is to keep inflation low. The other one is to keep unemployment low. And most of the time, it can only do one or the other, but it can't do both at the same time. For the last couple of years, for obvious reasons, it's been focusing solely on inflation. And although I think the Fed bears some blame for inflation going to 9% in the first place, they've done a really good job over the last 2.5 years of getting inflation not quite back to its 2% target, but close to it. And now that they're back close to that target, they're changing away from keeping an eye on inflation and moving towards keeping an eye on the labor market. Things are still good with the unemployment rate, but it's been ticking up the last few months, so the Fed is taking some early action to hopefully forestall a recession. I don't agree with that decision, but that's their line of reasoning.
Inflation has come down, obviously, dramatically from its high point, still, as you pointed out, above the target rate. Can we be confident that this lowering or lower rate of inflation is something that's going to be sustainable, or could it be transitory here? Because a lot of times when these things happen, you have sort of a rebound or bounce back effect.
I don't think this cut by itself will make the inflation rate go back up. And frankly, the only way it's going to go back to that 9% level is if Congress goes on another stimulus binge. During COVID, they passed $5 trillion or more of new spending. The Fed more or less has to help finance that. And when you inject that much money into the economy, that's how you get inflation. That's what happened. So unless that happens again, and I don't think it will because there's no crisis at hand, we're safe from that. But as far as getting it back to the target levels, if the Fed's taking its eye off the prize, markets know that. And if the economy does go south, if unemployment goes up, if growth slows down, markets know that the government's probably going to go back into stimulus mode. And the price of stimulus is inflation. It's a trade-off that there's nothing to be done about that, and that's frankly why inflation isn't back to its target level. It's a credibility issue.
In terms of that labor market, we recently had a correction in terms of jobs created here over the last few months of well over 800,000. Do you find that size of a correction? There's always some amount of a correction, but do you find the size of that to be somewhat stunning, and how does that even come about?
I was a little surprised by it, but I also do not think there was funny business going on. That happens on a schedule every August, every year. And some years it cuts in a way that favors the Democrats, like this year. Other years it cuts in a way that favors Republicans, like it did in 2022 and in 2019. $800,000 is on the big side for these corrections. They're usually between 2 and 500,000 jobs. So it's happened before, but not in probably 20 years where you've had an 800,000 job revision. So if I'm the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I might look into updating my methodology. So it's out of normal range, but not by too much.
So as you've pointed out, the Federal Reserve is sort of pivoting here from worrying about inflation to worrying about employment. How do those numbers affect that policy, and particularly when you have a correction of this size?
The rule of thumb is that when you lower interest rates, you stimulate the economy. If, say, you own a small business, when loans get cheaper, you have to pay lower interest, you're more likely to take out a loan in the first place. The thinking goes that when you lower interest rates, more people are going to take out mortgages, more businesses are going to take out loans to hire people and buy equipment. And the Fed meets every 6 weeks, so don't think of the recent cuts as a one-time event. They're going to cut again, probably by just a quarter point, in 6 weeks. I think it'll be mid-November when they meet, and then they have another one right before the end of the year, probably another cut coming then as well, another quarter point. So this is the start of a process. What happened recently is not that big a deal by itself, but like you said, it marks a turning point, and that is a big deal.
In terms of the average consumer, Ryan, you pointed out interest rates go down. It's more affordable for us to buy a new car, more affordable for somebody to take out a mortgage to buy a home, new home, or a larger home. But how long does it take a cut like that to actually perk its way through the system to a point where the consumer actually sees the impact?
Some of that's already priced in, especially with mortgage rates. They went from a high of 7.8% to, last time I looked, 6.2%. Still pretty high by historical standards, but markets have been expecting the Fed to make a cut for a while now. So part of that was already priced in. But usually when the Fed does something, it's a lag time of about 6 months, maybe a year, maybe longer. But some of that has already been priced in because most people saw this coming. The only debate was whether it was going to be a big or a small cut. Everyone knew that a cut was coming.
We, of course, have a presidential election coming up here in just a couple of weeks. And you did point out that federal spending has a big impact on inflation and interest rates and all these sorts of things. Do you see at this point markets, and they've been up, do you see sort of for the next 4 or 5 weeks, everybody just sort of standing still, being frozen in place, waiting to see who wins? And does who win really make that big of a difference in the end?
In the end, I don't think it will make that big of a difference. There's not a lot of daylight between the two parties when it comes to economic policy. They have their differences in other areas, but when it comes to deficit spending or entitlement reform or a lot of the more substantive economic issues, they're pretty similar. So I think whoever wins the presidential election won't have a big effect on markets in that regard, although Trump, the Republican nominee, has expressed a willingness to intervene in Federal Reserve interest rate policy, whereas Harris would likely take a little bit more of a hands-off approach. But all in all, there's not a lot of difference.
We have been talking with Ryan Young. Ryan, of course, is senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, tell us a bit about CEI. Also, you've written on this interest rate cut and many economic issues. Where can folks find those writings?
CEI is a think tank based in Washington, D.C., and our website is at CEI.org. You can see all of our research there at CEI.org.
Ryan Young, senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been keeping an eye on Capitol Hill's significant budget action this past week. Also, a number of races for the U.S. Senate and House are heating up. We're going to cover all of that with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let's start out. The federal budget, Scott, due by October 1st, never actually happens. There's this thing called a continuing resolution. Do we have one? What are the details?
Well, you remember last week, Speaker Johnson tried to pass a bill that was a six-month continuing resolution that would have avoided the lame duck session of Congress. And it also included a bill called the SAVE Act, which would have prevented illegal aliens from voting in federal elections. Unfortunately, that bill couldn't pass with just Republican votes. All the Democrats voted it down. And instead, Speaker Johnson had to kind of go back to the drawing board. This week, he announced that he was going to do just a three-month continuing resolution that was a so-called clean bill. The problem with this bill is that it expires on December 20th, and that creates this pressure during the lame duck to pass an omnibus appropriations bill, to tack on all these different anomalies, whether it's supplemental funding for the VA, emergency supplemental funding for disaster relief. You could also see the farm bill getting attached there, different tax extenders, various provisions that are funneling and fueling K Street special interests. It's the problem because there's not accountability for these members that are voting for it at the end of the Congress, some of which are retiring, some of which have lost their election. So conservatives wanted to try to avoid the lame duck session to prevent the Democrats from taking control of the negotiations and hopefully putting things into the Trump administration's power to do policies that we all want to see accomplish. This week, the House of Representatives went ahead, pulled up the bill underneath what's known as a suspension of the rules. So it required a two-third majority to pass rather than just a simple majority. And 82 Republicans voted against it. Every single Democrat voted yes, along with roughly 130 House Republicans. And unfortunately, that bill passed the U.S. House of Representatives, went over to the Senate. They had a couple of amendment votes, and ultimately only 18 U.S. senators voted against the bill. That's something that Biden's going to be signing into law before the fiscal year, and we will be facing a funding fight once again on December 20th. I think that it's unfortunate because you're basically rolling the dice. If Trump wins, right, there's a chance that they'll do some of the anomalies, but they'll say, well, you guys won the power and go ahead and kick it to the March. But if Trump loses, then you're going to be dealing with all the extra things that the Democrats want to adjudicate and sort of clean the barn out for Kamala Harris and her administration if she is successful in November. I obviously think we've got a good chance at winning the presidential election, but I can never really trust the uniparty in Washington, D.C. to do things in the best interest of the American people when it comes to federal funding. These omnibus appropriation bills, the continuing resolutions, have resulted in a funding system that has no fiscal restraint and ultimately, I think, is pouring gasoline on the fire of a burning economy that, you know, is really, really struggling at this time.
Well, that can has been kicked down the road, so we'll take up the conversation again in December, Scott. Let's switch now to politics. The map for the U.S. Senate very much favors Republicans this year, but two states, Texas and Florida, which we normally would assume would be just solidly in the Republican column, they're starting to become a little bit more of a battleground. What do you see happening in Texas and Florida?
Yeah, so the Democrat Senatorial Committee has long focused on two incumbent Republicans as their best pickup opportunities and chances to flip seats, right? So like on the other side of the coin, Republicans always knew that West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana were going to be the three best pickup opportunities. We've basically clinched West Virginia with Jim Justice. Things are looking really good for Tim Sheehy against John Tester. He's reportedly up about 7% right now. And Bernie Moreno and Sherrod Brown are in sort of a dogfight in Ohio. That being said, the Democrats are flush with cash, right? They have truckloads of cash. They don't even know where to spend it. So they're going back to the drawing board, expanding their map. And this week they announced big investments in Texas and Florida to try to defeat Ted Cruz in Texas and Rick Scott in the Sunshine State. We still obviously feel like Rick Scott and Ted Cruz are going to win those races. We think that Trump is going to easily win Florida and he's going to easily win Texas. But when you get down to these down ballot races, the Democrats, their candidates, their money, their posturing that they take does create an opportunity. And I think the Democrats are going all in to try to save their majority by picking off either Florida or Texas. Right now, things in Nevada with Sam Brown against Jackie Rosen, and then in Arizona with Kari Lake against Ruben Gallego. Those are a couple of coin flip races as well. They're going to, I think, ride on the coattails of Trump winning both of those states. And then in states like Maryland with Larry Hogan hoping to win that race, and Michigan with Mike Rogers against a really well-funded Alyssa Slotkin, Obviously, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is going to be ground zero for the presidential electoral map. There's also a competitive Senate race there with Dave McCormick taking on Bob Casey. There's a lot of options for Republicans to have a good night, but there aren't a lot of options for Democrats. And I think that's why you're seeing them being able to fully fund their incumbents that they want to defend, like Bob Casey and Jackie Rosen. And then they're also like, okay, well, if we're going to lose Montana and West Virginia, what can we do to somehow hold the majority? Oh, we got to win Florida or we got to win Texas. That's why you're seeing these big investments. We still feel confident in both of our Republican senators, Rick Scott and Ted Cruz, but they're going to be races to watch.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Well, the club is based out of Washington, D.C., and we're an economic organization focused on freedom, opportunity, and liberty. We also have a political action committee, Club for Growth PAC, and a super PAC called Club for Growth Action, where we endorse candidates and help them win their races through independent expenditures. If you want to learn all about the candidates like Scott Perry that we're supporting in 2024, visit clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You are welcome.
The proposed merger of Japan's Nippon Steel and U.S. Steel is in the best interests of U.S. Steel. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why.
Earlier this month, Vice President Kamala Harris became the latest prominent political figure to argue that the federal government ought to block the sale of U.S. Steel to a Japanese competitor. While campaigning in Pittsburgh, she said that U.S. Steel should remain American-owned and American-operated, and, quote, "I will always have the backs of America's steelworkers." This is a point of view that's shared by her boss, President Joe Biden, who the Washington Post has reported is considering taking action to block the potential sale of U.S. Steel to Japanese-based Nippon Steel, which has made an offer of nearly $15 billion to acquire U.S. Steel. And of course, that same position is held by President Donald Trump and Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. Vance has been actually particularly vocal on this issue since U.S. Steel announced the deal with Nippon Steel sometime last year. So in short, the four most prominent politicians in the country, sorry, Tim Walz, but everybody else seems to agree. U.S. Steel, a private company, they say, should not be allowed to conduct a private transaction with another private company unless the federal government, unless the president of the United States agrees. I think that's crazy. The government should leave U.S. Steel alone. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. As the Wall Street Journal's editorial board put it earlier this month, there's a lot of competition for the dumbest economic policy these days. Just in this presidential campaign, we've had candidates argue for price controls on food, for higher tariffs across the board, for national rent control of one form or another. But as the Journal's editorial board put it, quote, "Opposition to the Nippon deal deserves careful consideration for this distinct honor, given the deal's manifest benefits and non-existent harms." Now, I don't always agree with the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, but in this case, I think they absolutely nailed it. Nippon Steel's plan to buy U.S. Steel would give U.S. Steel something that politicians haven't been able to provide, a chance to actually be more competitive in the global marketplace. I mean, we hear a lot from both the left and the right these days about boosting blue-collar jobs, about steel workers in particular, manufacturing workers in Pennsylvania and Ohio and across the rest of the Rust Belt. But what those companies need, what companies like U.S. Steel need, what places like the Rust Belt need are more investment. And that's exactly what the Nippon deal would offer. Nippon has promised something like $2.7 billion in investments that would revamp U.S. Steel's plants. Now, it's usually correct to assume incompetence rather than malice when government officials are demonstrating wild economic illiteracy, but there's a little bit of malice involved here, too. That's because Cleveland-Cliffs, an Ohio-based steelmaker, an Ohio-based company, of course, which is where J.D. Vance is from, and that helps to explain his interest in this issue, they lost out to Nippon in the bidding war to purchase U.S. Steel last year. And since then, it's been Cleveland-Cliffs that has been leading the effort to get the government to block that deal over these completely imaginary, completely made up national security concerns. Now, unsurprisingly, Cleveland Cliffs also anticipates being able to buy U.S. steel on the cheap if the deal with Nippon gets blocked. The company's CEO told reporters recently that the Nippon deal should be blocked simply because Japan is not a friend of the United States. What? That's just naked cronyism wrapped in some nonsensical xenophobia. Japan is one of America's closest allies, has been for decades, and the Biden administration has actually worked to tighten that bond, has had repeated meetings with Japanese leaders in recent years. So that means that the political opposition to this deal between U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel is really a perfect example of why concentrating more economic power in Washington, D.C. would be a huge mistake. I think a lot of the confusion is just based on the name alone. I mean, U.S. Steel is a private company, despite the name that suggests it's somehow owned by the federal government or owned by all Americans or something like that. Nippon Steel, for that matter, is a private company, too. Yes, it's headquartered in Japan, but both of these companies are actually owned by their shareholders, which are people all over the world. This is not a case of a Japanese company versus an American company or buying an American company. It's just two private companies engaging in the sort of behavior that private companies engage in all the time without this sort of extra level of government scrutiny that gets applied here. Politicians that want to create more opportunities for American workers should be celebrating this deal. This is major foreign investment in American manufacturing. It's the sort of thing that is going to make U.S. Steel more competitive in the global marketplace, going to make it more effective in the American marketplace. It's going to mean that it can employ more people, that it can make more stuff. Isn't that what we want? Instead, the levers of power here are being manipulated by lobbyists and special interests to do the opposite, to cut off that foreign investment in pursuit of policies that will leave U.S. Steel and its employers and Americans in general worse off. The executives and shareholders of U.S. Steel are the ones who have the best interests of U.S. Steel in mind. They're the ones who made this decision to go through with this deal with Nippon. But if the Washington Post reporting is correct, the Biden administration is considering overruling their judgment, overruling the judgment of the people in charge of these two companies in the interests of political pandering and crony capitalism. And honestly, that's just gross. The federal government should butt out of this arrangement altogether. It's none of their business. Leave U.S. Steel alone. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this issue, of economic and fiscal policy issues, and everything else going on around the country and on the campaign trail at Reason.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of my new podcast, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, is the name of the show. On this week's episode, I'm investigating why thousands of kidneys and other organs that could be donated never make it to needy recipients. It's an infuriating story, and it's a story ultimately about the failures of a monopolistic government contractor. And, you know, kind of like the U.S. Steel deal is another reason why you shouldn't get the government involved in something that it doesn't need to be doing. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Oprah Winfrey offered up a series of softball questions in her interview with Kamala Harris, and Harris still swung and missed with her answers. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Last week, Oprah Winfrey pretended to interview Kamala Harris. Matt Walsh on YouTube called it the most cringy and unintelligible ramble we've ever heard. The upside of it was that viewers got to see clearly the case of an interviewee and an interviewer who were manifestly on the same side. Listen to how she answers, or more accurately, fails to answer, a softball final question from Oprah.
What is on your heart to say to the American people as we have 47 days until November 5th? What's on your heart? To say to particularly those people who are still undecided or maybe indifferent or on the fence still?
We love our country. I love our country. I know we all do. That's why everybody's here right now. We love our country. We take pride in the privilege of being American. And this is a moment where We can and must come together as Americans, understanding we have so much more in common than what separates us. Let's come together with the character that we are so proud of about who we are, which is we are an optimistic people. We are an optimistic people. Americans, by character, are people who have dreams and ambitions and aspirations. We believe in what is possible. We believe in what can be. And we believe in fighting for that. That's how we came into being. Because the people before us understood that one of the greatest expressions for the love of our country, one of the greatest expressions of patriotism, is to fight for the ideals of who we are, which includes freedom to make decisions about your own body, freedom to be safe from gun violence, freedom to have access to the ballot box, freedom to be who you are and just be, to love who you love openly and with pride, freedom to just be. And that's who we are. We believe in all that. And so this is a moment where we stand knowing what we are fighting for. We're not fighting against. It's what we're fighting for.
Thank you.
That closing, when she says that her supporters know what they are fighting for, is especially damning because, of course, she never says what they're fighting for. Calling it a word salad is unfair to salads. It's just tonal without substance. Setting a tone is fine, but if it isn't followed by substance, it's empty, vacuous, content-free. And the legacy media is committing journalistic malpractice by letting her get away with it. One courageous voice out there who isn't afraid to call it what it is respected political commentator Charles Cook. He summed up his analysis of that sham interview with this devastating comment. I am aware by now that people are voting against, and that they are going to pretend, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, that their candidate is therefore fine. But they're not. They're not fine. Kamala Harris is not an acceptable candidate for President of the United States. She can't answer elementary questions. She can't talk. And the reason that she can't talk is because she can't think. The mouth follows the mind. Wow. This has been Colin Hanna for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WXLI AM and FM in Dublin, Georgia, WMAN AM and FM in Mansfield, Ohio, along with KIRC-FM in Shawnee, Oklahoma. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.